In 2004, the internet search engine Yahoo compiled a top 10 list of the words web searchers want to define, and that particular year, the top two words were veracity, which is simply another word for truth, and love. Yahoo concluded the report noting that, quote, many of us are still trying to find meaning for some of life's littlest big words. Perhaps this report also reveals that truth and love still matter to the average person. John wrote in our passage this morning in 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 18 that truth and love were essentially connected to each other. Look at verse 18 of 1 John chapter 3. Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. Now, John here is in his second contrast. As we look at the flow of his argument here, his second contrast between the life of a Christian and the life of a non-Christian, between the lifestyle of a believer and the lifestyle of an unbeliever. The first contrast was between sin and righteousness. That is, the lifestyle of an unbeliever is sinful, the lifestyle of a believer is righteous. His second contrast in this chapter is between hate and love. The believer is filled with love, the unbeliever is the one who demonstrates hate. We know we are Christians, John says, because the love of God has filled our lives, and we show the love of God by our love for others. It is a lifestyle of love that characterizes the believer. A zeal for righteousness without love leads to legalism. Unfortunately, we see an awful lot of legalism, of this unloving righteousness demonstrated by believers as we react to the culture in which we live. John tells us that an unloving righteousness, an unloving righteous zeal is deadly and can even lead to hate. The very opposite of what ought to characterize believers. It shows that we do not love, we do not have the love of God. And John goes on then to explain the love of God, God's kind of love. God's love is not a love, he says in verse 18, with just word or tongue. God's love is not a love that just claims to love others with our lips while hating them with our behavior, essentially, contradicting the claim we are making of knowing God's love. God's kind of love shows itself, John says, in act and in truth. So, God's love is love in action. God's love is demonstrated by what we do, not what we say. Telling someone you love them means nothing if what you do denies the love. So John will explain this kind of love in action in these verses. But there is another component to love that he lays out here. It is not just in deed or in act, in work. It is also in truth. Truth is necessary to love God's kind of love. Truth means that there is no enabling in God's kind of love. We do not enable others to continue in sinful behavior in the name of love, in the name of loving them. We do not enable them to continue. We are truthful in our relationship with them. We act truthfully toward other people. We are faithful and we are reliable. We are honest and genuine in all we do. and we confront error in love. The two have to go together. We don't just ignore the truth and pretend that we love one another. That kind of love is not God's kind of love either. So God's love is tough and tender, truth-filled and compassionate. And it is that balance that is so difficult, is it not, in our lives? First of all, this morning, then we're backtracking from verse 18 where he stated his thesis, and now we look back at verses 16 and 17 to see how John developed this argument. And first of all, God's love, he says, calls for self-sacrifice, for sacrificial action. Verse 16, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. God's love calls for self-sacrifice. A year ago, the nation watched as a tragedy unfolded at Virginia Tech University. And we've been reliving some of those stories in the news media in the last few weeks. As a gunman stormed Norris Hall at Virginia Tech University, the students in Professor Liviu Librescu's classroom could hear the shouts. They could hear the gunfire coming down the hallway to their room. And realizing what was happening, Professor Librescu, a 76-year-old professor who had survived the Holocaust himself, urged the students out the window of the classroom as he braced himself against the doorway so the gunman couldn't enter the classroom. An article in the New York Daily News reports that most of the students hung out of the windows and dropped about 10 feet to bushes and grass below. Librescu stayed behind to hold off the crazed gunman. Alec Calhoun, age 20, said the last thing he saw before he jumped from the window as he looked back was Librescu blocking the door against the madman in the hallway. He died trying to protect the students. Self-sacrifice is at the heart of love. And we respond to examples of self-sacrifice like that one because we understand that it is at the center of what love is. Now, as Christians, we have, as great an example as that is, we have an even greater example of self-sacrificing love. And John is referring to the greatest example of self-sacrificial love in the universe, and that is Jesus Christ. For Jesus left his heavenly home, and he came to earth. He became a man. He lived as a man, and he died on a cross. Jesus was not just martyred or killed, he gave his life, John says. And the scriptures teach us that Jesus voluntarily gave his life, and he gave his life on that cross in our place so that we too might be right with God. His sacrifice for us was a gift. And John uses that analogy and he says, okay, if you know the love of God, then, if his sacrifice is a gift to us, then our sacrifice, our love, is a gift to others. We give our lives on behalf of others, John says, because Christ gave all he had in behalf of us. Obviously, dying for someone is the ultimate sacrifice, as Professor Librescu has demonstrated. However, most of us are not called to actually die physically for someone else. Martyrdom, after all, is pretty rare. We are all called, however, to sacrifice ourselves for others in love. We are called to live lives of self-sacrifice as the demonstration of God's love. And it is not just some Christians, you know, the special ones that are called to self-sacrificing love. It is all Christians. It is all believers. A lifestyle of self-sacrificing love is the characteristic of a Christian. God's love is a call then to die to self, to self-interest, so that we can live for Him. It is all of us who are called to self-sacrifice. And in life, God gives us a multitude of opportunities to demonstrate that kind of sacrificial love, that dying to self every day of our lives by choosing to sacrifice our self-interests for someone else. One way is by giving ourselves to missions, and we emphasize missions here, and we talk about missions. Every Christian, however, should be involved in missions in some way. We are all to be global Christians. The Great Commission isn't just for some special people, it is for all believers. We can invest ourselves in missions in a variety of ways. We can pray, we can give, we can serve on short-term teams, wonderful in today's world with the mobility and everything that we have to be able to do that. And I think of our Katrina teams the last few years and how they have demonstrated self-sacrificing love for other people. In New Orleans, for example, parents, when I do baby dedications, I often ask this question: are you willing to let go of your children if God calls them to a place where you wouldn't really want them to be or to go? That's a tough question for parents. But it's self-sacrificing love to let them go if God calls them there, into full-time vocational missions or to some other place, rather than to be comfortably near us at home. That is Christian love. We have many opportunities for self-sacrifice in our marriages. Every day there are many different opportunities to demonstrate sacrificial love to your spouse. You say, well, Dave, where does my happiness enter this picture? I'm not happy in this marriage. Don't I deserve to be happy? And so often I hear that now. We hear that in this world. I'm not happy, so I'm going to find where I can get happiness because I'm not happy in this marriage. Don't I deserve to be happy? I've heard that many times. Not necessarily. And not apart from God. The real issue is, where does eternal happiness come from? We think happiness comes from getting what we want in life, right now, right here. But real happiness, eternal happiness, comes from finding our happiness in God. And God calls us to love others sacrificially. So we find that happiness in sacrificial love. It's counterintuitive to our human nature. But we will find real happiness in sacrifice, just as God the Father found His greatest happiness in the sacrifice of His Son for us. That's amazing. I don't deserve it, do you? Poured out hell on Him for us. That's love. And in that process, God is results in happiness. Eternal, lasting happiness. We may not experience this happiness in the short term, but in the long term, the happiness we find in God will surpass the happiness we can ever hope to find in self. And that's why God gives us opportunities to love our spouses. God's kind of love, with a serving, sacrificing love. Sacrificing our self-interest for our family members, our children, for example. God calls parents to sacrifice their wants for their needs of their children. So often today, people won't do that. I want what I want, so I'm going to get what I want. But God calls parents to sacrifice themselves for the needs of their children. Many people today belong to the sandwich generation. So it's not just children, but parents. And God calls us to sacrificially love not just our children, but our parents. And both needs, as people live longer, come to press upon us. Caring for both parents and children at the same time. Some of you are in that category. And it creates great opportunities for self-sacrifice. Did you hear the word I used? Opportunities. We don't often think of them as opportunities, do we? They're more stressors. They're stressful, yes. They're also God-given opportunities to demonstrate His kind of love in everyday life. How about submitting ourselves to one another in church? The petty squabbles we go through in our relationships with others are opportunities to show love. The disagreements we have with others in ministry and in church are opportunities to show sacrificial love. We don't have to have our way in everything that we're doing. We can sacrifice ourselves for the good of others. We can respond with kindness and generosity even when other people wrong us and hurt us. There are so many ways to die to self. They are God's opportunities for us to learn His kind of love and to practice it in life. And you can think of many, many other examples. These are just a few categories to get us thinking about the way God sets us up to show His love in this world. Jesus said, "If any man would come after me, he must what? He must what? Deny himself. Take up his cross and follow me." Self-denial. It's not a pleasant or a popular topic, but it's God's kind of topic. It's a call to love God and to love other people. It's a call for sacrificial love. So what is the cross that He calls you to carry? It's His appointment for your love. In his book, Dad, the Family Coach, Dave Simmons describes the shape love took in the life of his daughter. 8-year-old Helen and 5-year-old Brandon went with their dad to the Cloverleaf Mall in Hattiesburg to do a little shopping. And as they drove up in the parking lot outside of Sears, they saw a Peterbilt 18-wheeler that was set up there with a petting zoo. All set up in the parking lot, and the kids were all excited. "Daddy, can we go? Daddy, can we go?" And he thought it was a great opportunity, and so he flipped a quarter to each of them, and they headed off to the petting zoo, and he walked into Sears to look for a scroll saw. And as he was walking along, thinking, "Well, this is great. They're all taken care of, and I can look for my scroll saw in peace," he turned around and there was his daughter Helen following behind him. He said, "Helen, what's going on? I thought you went to the petting zoo." She looked at him and she sadly said, "Well, Daddy, it cost 50 cents. I gave Brandon my quarter." Aww. Don't you wish all families worked this way? Then she said, Dave went on to say, then she said the most beautiful thing he had ever heard. She repeated the family motto. The family motto is, love is action. Okay? She had given Brandon her quarter, and no one loves cuddly, furry little creatures more than Helen. But she had heard and she had seen her parents constantly live out the motto, love is action. It is deeds. It is doing something, not just saying something. And she had incorporated it into her little 8-year-old lifestyle. It had become a part of her. So as soon as he finished his errands, he took Helen back to the petting zoo, and they stood by the fence and they watched Brandon go crazy petting and feeding the animals. Helen stood by the fence with her hands and her chin resting on the fence, just absorbing all of his experiences. They said, I had 50 cents burning a hole in my pocket. He never offered it to Helen, and she never asked for it. You see, she knew the whole family motto. She'd shortened it. It's not love is action. It's love is sacrificial action. And he writes, love always pays a price. Love always costs something. Love is expensive. When you love, benefits accrue to another's account. Love is for you, not for me. Love gives, it doesn't grab. Helen gave her quarter to Brandon and wanted to follow through on her lesson. She knew she had to taste the sacrifice. She wanted to experience that total family motto, love is sacrificial action. And he wanted her to follow through for her benefit. See, the home is the perfect place to practice love. And boy, do we have opportunities to do just that in the home. There are 100 different ways to do something that costs something for someone right at home. Secondly, God's love calls for personal action. Verse 17, not just sacrificial action, but personal action. Verse 17, and whoever has the world's goods and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him, remain in him? Here's a little cartoon. Of course I love people, at least in a theological sense. What does that mean? What does it mean to love someone in a theological sense? Perhaps it means that's, you know, sort of theoretical and safe and, you know, theology's up here, right? Can we love people theologically but not practically? Can we love people theoretically but not personally? In theory, I love you all. Now, don't you feel good this morning? Theologically, I love every one of you in this room. But don't ask me to do anything for you, right? Telling someone you love them means nothing if what you do denies the love. John tells us that if we have this world's goods and we don't help someone in need, then we what? Don't have the love of God remaining in us. It's not there. Love is intensely practical and intensely personal. God's love calls for personal action to meet the needs of others. If we claim to love God, then we have to share what we have with other people. We cannot claim to love God but not love others. It's our familiar, at least it ought to be by now, love triangle in the letter of 1 John. We ought to be pretty familiar with this love triangle by now. Every relationship, every Christian relationship is really a triangle of relationships. There is God, there is you, there is me. There are always three people involved. John is telling us that if I don't love you, then what? I don't really love God. We sang about loving God this morning. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's wonderful to sing about loving God. But do we? Because if I don't love you, then I don't love God. The love of God is not remaining in me. If I close my heart to your needs, then I'm closing my heart to God as well. If I live for myself, then I'm not living for God. If I love myself, then I don't love God. We cannot claim to know the love of God in our lives and close our hearts to the needs of other people. The love triangle doesn't work that way. Love is not words. Love is sacrificial action. And love is personal action. We do love. We don't just profess love. No, when we look at the church, oftentimes people look at the church and they see really the cross of Christ, his sacrificial love clothed in dollar bills. They look at the church and they see money. That's the reality with which we live. And all too often, there's some truth in that reality, where our buildings and our budgets and our programs become more important than people. And in this Western culture in which we live, that is a great temptation. And that is not God's love. I'm not saying that those things aren't important. They have value. But if Christianity becomes associated only with those things and not with people and not with loving people and meeting their needs, then we've got a problem. People come first. Is that not correct? We say that, yet oftentimes we don't live that way as a body of believers. We have many opportunities to love others in our ministry here at Galilee, so I'm not just ragging on everybody this morning. As I was preparing this morning, I was praying, Lord, this applies greatly to me just as much as it does to anybody else. And in our ministry here, we certainly have many opportunities to show God's love tangibly, physically, materially, to meet people's needs. Next Sunday is the first Sunday of the month. Each first Sunday, we have these little envelopes in the bulletins, and all the money in those envelopes goes into our caregiving fund, which is used to meet the needs of people in our church. And by the way, if you ever know of any needs of believers, then contact one of the pastors, contact one of the elders. We are glad to help financially with those needs. We also have a storehouse fund. The caregiving fund is for needs within the church. The storehouse fund is for needs in the greater community at large. And at any time, you mark an envelope, storehouse fund or caregiving fund, and give that way materially to help people in need. You can contribute that way at any time. It's a tangible way to show your love for others by sharing of this world's goods. But there are many other ways. Once a month, on the second Monday night of each month, there's a group of people from our church who join other Christians to show God's love in tangible ways at the Wayside Soup Kitchen, where they serve meals. Other Christians show God's love in tangible ways through ministries like Abba, caring for unwed mothers. Others from our fellowship work with the Root Cellar, which ministers to the needy in Portland. Others work in the youth center and serve that way, or the correctional center. And I'm just naming some of the ways that people in our fellowship are demonstrating the love of Christ in very tangible ways in this community. And those are good. They are important. And they are ways that you can show God's love through the ministry of a corporate assembly like the Galilee Baptist Church, and that's good. But that's really not quite what John is talking about here, is it? Those are all valuable, they're all good. It's really not what quite what he's talking about. What he's talking about is personal connection. Do you see a need? Do you have a way to meet that need? And do you personally respond to that need? That primarily works with people we know, our co-workers, our family members, our neighborhoods, that sort of thing. And John calls us to love others personally. He sets up three conditions for demonstrating that love in this verse. First of all, I must have the necessary material resources. Literally, what John says here is that we hold the life of the world. We who hold the life of the world. Now, that was an idiom in the first century for holding the necessary resources to live well in this world. The goods that made life a good life in this world. Do we hold those things? Do we have those things? The material goods. So if we have the material resources for a good life, by the way, I suspect that that's probably most of us in this room, honestly. If we have the material resources to live this world's life and be comfortable, then we meet the first condition. Second, I must see the need. God certainly doesn't hold me accountable for meeting a need I don't know about, nor you. Now, the problem, of course, is in that in this information age we live in today, I don't know about you, but we see way more need than we can respond to because we see so much of the whole world's needs. Now, we have to remain available to help with them, and we live in a culture and a country that has so much, and part of this world has so little. Much of this world has so little, so we have to remain available to help people in need globally with their needs. For God has blessed us materially in incredible ways. But John is primarily here looking not at the needs of starving people in Ethiopia, as important as that is, and we ought to help where we can and give where we can, and every one of us has, and it's challenging to me to think about it every time I look at these things. But John is primarily looking personally, isn't he? Do we have personal contact with people who have needs that we can meet with the resources that God has given to us? That's the first test. It's personal. Then, do we have a heart for this world? And know about those needs too. Third, I must open my heart to share. There we go. Now, John puts it in the negative, of course. But this is a positive principle. I must not close my heart to the needs of others because that's not God's kind of love. Now, before we move on, let me throw in a little caveat here. I like those things. I like that word, by the way. Unfortunately, I've found over the years that some people's needs are not real needs. You've probably experienced that too. The word for need here means that which is necessary for life. It's a need. John is not saying that everything people want is a need. And in my first years in ministry down in New Jersey, I faced that a lot where people would respond to the gospel message, but all they really were looking for was a handout. And then you'd give the handout and they'd go buy some television with it or something, you know. Every want is not a need. And we live in a world where some people learn to use the generosity of others for their own selfishness. And if that is the case, then what do? We have to apply the tough side of love, don't we? Remember, love is in act and in truth. Love is both action and truth. Truth requires us to withhold tangible help if that tangible help is simply enabling someone else to continue in their life of sin. I'm not going to give somebody money so they can go out and get drunk. That's not loving. But when we withhold that tangible help, we had better make sure it's for the right reason and not just because I want to spend it on me on something else. That's not the right reason, is it? The truth is that this is less of a problem for most of us than the flip side. We have more than we need, but the truth is that we often don't want to help others in need. That's the real problem. We live in an affluent country. We rely on the government to do something for the needs of others rather than getting personally involved. But folks, we have brothers and sisters in Christ who are starving while we fight obesity. There's something wrong there. And I don't want to gloss over that. That reality convicts me. But do I do much about it? Not nearly as much as I ought to. Statistically, in America, and this has been brought out time and time again, statistically in America, as the income goes up, what happens? The giving goes down. That's the reality of money in America. We don't live on less, we give less. The greatest percentage of giving comes from the poorer segments of churches. That's the reality, and of course it ought not to be. So we ought to let this convict us and hit us, not gloss over it. If we know of a need and we can meet that need, then our first response should be to open our hearts to share what we can. That's God's kind of love. Dr. Scott Kurtzman, chief of surgery at Waterbury Hospital, was on his way to deliver an 8 a.m. lecture to college students when he witnessed one of the worst crashes in Connecticut history. A dump truck whose driver had lost control flipped on its side and skidded into oncoming traffic. The resulting accident involved 20 vehicles and 4 people died. Thanks to years of emergency room experience, Dr. Kurtzman immediately shifted into trauma mode. He worked his way through the mangled mess of people and metal, calling out, "Who needs help?" After about an hour and a half, when all 16 victims had been triaged and taken to area hospitals, Dr. Kurtzman climbed back into his car, drove to the medical school, and gave his lecture 2 hours late. That was not the first time that Dr. Kurtzman had done that. Over the years, he stopped at a half a dozen crashes and assisted at 3. A person with my skills simply can't drive by someone who's injured, says Kurtzman. I refuse to live my life that way. I refuse to live my life that way. That ought to be the motto of every Christian. I refuse to live my life that way. But like many in our culture, we let someone else take care of it. You remember the story of the loaves and fishes. 5,000 men, along with women and children, had gathered to listen to Jesus teach that day. When evening came and the people were hungry, Jesus told the disciples to give the people food. Give them supper. And the disciples said, "Hey, we haven't got any money to buy food, and it's long ways into town, and we don't have any food to give them." And Jesus said what? Well, what do you have? And one of the disciples said, well, there is this boy, and he has 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Jesus said, take that and give it to the people. And, of course, Jesus performed a great miracle. But why didn't Jesus just do the miracle? Here was this little boy. Now, his mom probably sent him out that morning prepared for the day, right? Here's your supper. You got to take care of it so you'll have food, because moms do that. But everybody else came unprepared. And the disciples, what are we supposed to do with that? And yet, he did perform a miracle, but only after they looked at the overwhelming need and gave 5 loaves and 2 fishes from the little boy for people who were unprepared. Why? Because God tries to teach us how he can meet overwhelming needs with limited resources. That's God. He multiplies the little into much if we share the little we have to meet the need of many. That's God's way. And we're involved. In the 1980s, Kevin Bradley was engrossed in the fast-paced, big-money world of Wall Street. A stockbroker by trade, he worked for Legg Mason in Baltimore. Bradley and his wife Marilyn led a comfortable life. But every day God was drawing him away from the rich to the homeless. He'd seen them each day as he walked to the office, gradually learned to love the homeless people he met on his way to the office, often taking them to breakfast, lending a listening, caring ear. I got really interested in who they were and how they got to where they were, says Bradley. He didn't particularly want a mission to the homeless, but he knew God was asking him to fulfill a call to ministry he'd sensed as a youth. And in 1991, after much prayer and Bible study, Bradley quit his lucrative job and he started the Community Outreach Center in Baltimore. Now the Outreach Foundation, it's a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping the homeless become independent citizens. In addition to meeting emergency needs, the foundation offers the Wings Life Skills Training Program developed by Bradley. The motivational spiritual program teaches men and women how to channel their God-given talents and desires into productive careers. At first, they lived off their savings. That became tough when they were raising less than $10,000 a year. Bradley says, there were times when I'd come home and we probably had less food in our pantry than some of the people we were helping. Eventually, their perseverance paid off. Today, they have many financial backers. The Outreach Foundation in Bel Air, Maryland continues to grow, and the Wings program, training people for life and careers in this world, is being used by organizations nationwide now. All because someone decided to love with their 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Father, we look at the needs and we go, wow, I don't know how to meet those needs. And yet you don't call us to give what we don't have. You call us to give what we have in love. You call us to love one another in this fellowship, and to give that love to others in need. Help us this week to live that kind of loving lifestyle. In Jesus' name, amen.